Questions about Nancy Pelosi are back. Arguments against gerrymandering are back. And Ken Rudin is back on The Political Junkie.
Thanks, Mom. I'm Ken Rudin. Mitch McConnell's task of winning Senate votes on the GOP health care plan gets an extension.
Legislation of this complexity almost always takes longer than anybody else would hope. But we're going to press on. We think the status quo is unsustainable, and we're optimistic we're going to get to a result that's better than the status quo.
Plus, the Trump administration gets a victory of sorts with the ruling on the travel ban.
I'm not sure I would call it a clear victory. I think it was a compromise. But if it had gone the other way, it would have certainly been a clear defeat.
And the age-old political tactic of redistricting and gerrymandering may get its first tough look by the Supreme Court.
The case that's coming up to the court now is the latest opportunity for the court to weigh in detail on how much partisanship might be too much, how you know how much is too much, and who should tell how much is too much.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 185 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. And, as my neurosurgeon will tell you, I'm back.
Oh, my God. He's the man behind the mask. And he's out of control. He's back. The man behind the mask.
And having undergone successful back surgery 2 weeks ago, what better way to return to the show to talk about healthcare? Forgive us if we're having a case of deja vu this week with the Senate Republicans' effort to pass their version of healthcare. It reminded us of what the Democrats and leader Harry Reid had to do back in 2009 when President Obama was pushing his signature Affordable Care Act. Back then, Reid was doing whatever he could to get the votes he needed to pass Obamacare. Several of his Democratic colleagues were not sold on it. They needed to be persuaded. Reid did the persuasion. Republicans said it felt more like extortion. Remember the so-called Cornhusker kickback, which sent more Medicaid money to Nebraska to get Democrat Ben Nelson's vote? Here's what Utah Republican Orrin Hatch said about it at the time.
To a lot of us, we were very, very upset about it. It was very poorly done, but the only way they could get it through was basically to bribe their members. It was very sour stuff to most people in this country. They realized that this is not the way to legislate.
There was more. Millions given to the Bayou State, the so-called Louisiana Purchase, to win Mary Landrieu's vote. Other deals were made to win over other Democrats as well. Republicans mocked them throughout the process. But in the end, Democrats needed 60 votes to pass it, and they got it. Barely. Here was Vice President Biden announcing the vote.
The yeas are 60, the nays are 39, H.R. 3590 as amended, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is passed.
Democrats passed Obamacare with no Republican votes. Now the roles are reversed. If Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is going to get this bill passed, and that's still an if, he would rather do it without any Democratic votes. Not that any Democrats are offering. He's going to have to sweeten the deal to bring enough Republicans on board. Since the Senate proposal went public late last week, at least six GOP lawmakers have said they couldn't vote for it. Susan Collins of Maine, Dean Heller of Nevada, Ted Cruz of Texas, Rand Paul of Kentucky, Mike Lee of Utah, and Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Johnson said it didn't make sense to force a vote before the July 4th holiday anyway, especially since there was no assurance of it passing. Here he is on NBC's Meet the Press.
We don't have enough information. I don't have the feedback from constituencies who will not have had enough time to review the Senate bill. We should not be voting on this next week, but we should have started the process reaching out to the Democrats, pointing out the fact that Obamacare didn't work. It did drive premiums up more than double nationally. Some places three times have been, has been the increase in premiums. Let's acknowledge that. Let's repair the damage done by Obamacare and transition to something that works.
And with the votes of other Republicans in doubt, not to mention the analysis from the Congressional Budget Office that said the bill would increase the number of people without insurance by 22 million by 2026, the leadership had no choice but to pull it from this week's schedule. Here was McConnell on Tuesday.
We're going to continue the discussions within our conference on the differences that we have that we're continuing to try to litigate. Consequently, we will not be on the bill this week, but we're still working toward getting at least 50 people in a comfortable place.
It was the only move that made sense. Perhaps, as we saw in the House, the Senate will have to come back a second time with improved language if they're going to get it passed. And oh, did I tell you that the Supreme Court will be taking a look at gerrymandering this fall? That means it's another shameless opportunity to bring my mom back on the program with the trivia question.
The subject of gerrymandering leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last member of the House who lost his seat because of redistricting and later ran for president? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Thanks, Mom. We'll give you the answer to our last trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. Republicans may have dodged a bullet by postponing the health care vote until after the July 4th break. Mitch McConnell is not the kind of guy who would schedule a vote only to see it lose. He may not be the most ideological guy in the leadership or even the most huggable, which is important to us sensitive types, but he is a superb tactician and he knows how to win. And it didn't look like he had a winning hand. The delay may have given undecided Republican senators breathing room, or maybe just an opportunity to get some goodies from McConnell to win over their vote. But it's not going to be an easy decision for Nevada's Dean Heller, who may be the most vulnerable Republican senator up in 2018. He votes no, he's all but assured of a primary challenge from the right, which he might get anyway. He votes yes, he's guaranteed to be a top target of state Democrats, which he probably is anyway. John Ralston knows more about Nevada politics than anybody on the planet. He's the publisher of the Ralston Report blog and the editor of the Nevada Independent. You'll just have to forgive him for his Buffalo, New York accent. John, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
I appreciate the forgiveness in advance, Ken.
That's right. Well, what I love about Buffalo is I always go there to celebrate the bicentennial.
That's right. I'm actually going to Buffalo in about 10 days for a high school reunion, the number of which I shall keep secret.
It'll be our secret. Anyway, we'll get to that secret and we'll get to Senator Heller's re-election concerns a little later. But going back to Heller's announcement when he decided to oppose the health care bill, he sounded pretty definitive. Let's listen to him.
My point of being here today is to tell you that this bill that's currently in front of the United States Senate, not the answer. It's simply not the answer. And I'm announcing today that in this form, I will not support it. Barring significant changes from the Congressional Budget Office, this bill will mean a loss of coverage for millions of Americans.
And he said that before the CBO numbers came out, and the CBO numbers were terrible as well. So this wasn't a wishy-washy statement from Heller at all.
No, it really wasn't. He was, as you said, fairly definitive. He spoke right after the very popular Republican governor, Brian Sandoval, spoke and talked about all the benefits of expanding Medicaid, which Heller had not supported in the past, but which has put close to 300,000 now more Nevadans on the health care rolls. And Sandoval was, as you know, was the first Republican governor to expand Medicaid. So he hung his hat on those Medicaid health care patients and on Governor Sandoval's 65-70% approval rating, Ken. But he said even more. He said that it was a lie for people to say that the bill would reduce premiums. And he lamented that tens of millions of Americans, he wasn't just speaking about Nevadans, would be kicked off health care. So for all the Democrats who said, well, you can't trust Heller, he's going to flip back to a yes, it's going to be very difficult, and Heller said this himself, to get him back to a yes.
But as you say, I can't imagine listening to Heller in that statement and then suddenly saying, you know what, you know, McConnell convinced me, I'm going to vote yes.
I don't see how he does that. And you see all kinds of cockamamie theories going around now, Ken, that McConnell's going to promise Dean Heller that he will kill Yucca Mountain, the nuclear waste dump, which is moving forward very quickly in Congress, if Heller will just vote for the health care bill. I just don't see anything like that happening. And what you can be sure of, Ken, is there's no chance that Heller will vote yes unless Brian Sandoval, the governor, who Heller cites in almost every statement, says that he will support the bill. And I just don't see how they can change that bill enough to get Sandoval on board.
Well, Sandoval has almost made Obamacare popular in Nevada, hasn't he?
Well, I don't know if I go that far, but it's very difficult not to listen to that press conference you referred to and not think that Sandoval and Heller were doing testimonials for Obamacare, the way that they talked about the expansion of Medicaid. Now, of course, that's not the only part of Obamacare, and Sandoval still says he has problems with the Affordable Care Act, et cetera. But this is what's going on in the country now. As you know, Obamacare has only become more popular during this debate over the Republicans' efforts to repeal it.
Well, we know that Heller's under a lot of pressure. Let me play the tagline from an ad by the AARP.
Tell Senator Heller, vote no on the health care bill.
And then he heard the opposite message from this tagline of an ad from the pro-Trump America First Policies Super PAC.
Now, with strong leadership and a real chance to repeal and replace Obamacare with patient-centered care that protects American families, Senator Dean Heller is saying no. Call Senator Heller. Tell him America needs him to keep his promise. Vote yes to repeal and replace Obamacare.
He's clearly, he's being pulled in two directions.
Yeah, and he asked for that by the way that he's handled this. Now, I should say, as you know, those America First ads were pulled after Heller met with a bunch of other Republican senators with the president and apparently raised those ads as being very irritating, and I think that's a euphemism, Ken, for how he feels about it. But, you know, he has been very, very equivocal on how he's talked about this bill and about expanding Medicaid, which he has previously opposed, and then he's talked in different ways about phasing out Medicaid. So there is a no-win situation here for Heller, and so the political calculation, I think, which is the least painful, is the one that he made. But immediately after he was at that press conference with Sandoval, there were rumblings of a primary challenge with perennial candidate Danny Tarkanian, who loses general elections but wins primaries once in a while, talking about getting into that race. And depending on what he does, I think Dean Heller will have a primary. Whether he'll be able to fend that off or not is a different question. But Nevada's a strange state, as you well know, Ken, with very low turnout primaries in June of the election year. Almost anything can happen.
Is Sandoval strong enough to provide him enough cover?
Sandoval, while he remains very popular, including among Republicans, among the electorate that would vote in that June primary, assuming a very low turnout, is not as popular. He raised taxes by $1.5 billion a couple of legislative sessions ago, very unpopular with the Republican base. But Sandoval is a much more skillful and popular politician than Dean Heller, and certainly would try to save him, I would guess. But again, at the end of June in 2017, it's very hard to forecast what's going to happen in 2018.
Well, one thing we do know, Heller's the only Republican up next year running in a state that Hillary Clinton won.
And that's right. And Hillary Clinton won here. But Dean Heller has gone against the tide before. I mean, he should have lost in 2012. As you know, Ken, Obama won the state by 6 points, and Heller still managed to survive by 12,000 votes against Shelley Berkley. Now, Shelley Berkley may have been the only Democrat who could have lost to Heller that year. She happened to be under House ethics investigation at the time, which was a real break for Heller. But he's been counted out before and come back to win. So I think he's in big, big trouble. His numbers in polling I've seen here, Ken, are even lower than Donald Trump's here. He's got about a 35% approval rating. So it's very, very difficult to overcome that. But, you know, the Democrats have recruited a congresswoman who's barely been in politics for a cup of coffee. She just got elected. She's never been in elective office before. We have no idea what kind of candidate she's going to be in a statewide race.
You're talking about Jackie Rosen, right?
That's Jackie Rosen. And now you have Dina Titus, who was a senior to her in the congressional delegation, very upset that Jackie Rosen has suddenly been anointed, and Dina Titus is taking a poll and thinking about getting into that race herself. And if she does, which I still think is relatively unlikely, that's a real problem for the Democrats, because Titus, I think, could grind up Jackie Rosen in that primary.
But you had a piece this week in the Nevada Independent that, entitled Why Dean Heller Won't Be Reelected. Now, we both agree this is midway of 2017. We have a long way to go, but is that just still your gut feeling? Because he seems like he's being attacked from both sides very strongly.
Yeah, that was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I do think he's in big, big trouble. And I did, if you read to the end of that column, point out that he's been counted out before, as I alluded to earlier, and still come back. And it is a long way off, but even Heller's people, I think, understand that he's in big trouble. They think that Trump, if his approval rating is still mired in the 30s somewhere, is going to be a real albatross for Heller, that if the Democrats can get their act together, remember we're in the post-Harry Reid era, even though Harry Reid sits in his office at the Bellagio Hotel on the Strip and still directs traffic a little bit, but he's not as involved. And so what will the Democratic Party look like? They have a registration advantage now of about 6 points or so. Can they keep that up? Will there be primaries on both sides? There are some unanswered questions, but it's clear that Dean Heller is very, very vulnerable and probably, and you'd know this better than I, the most vulnerable incumbent in the country.
John Ralston is the publisher of the Ralston Report blog and the editor of the Nevada Independent, which can be found at thenevadaindependent.com. John, thank you as always.
Ken, always a pleasure.
Did you ever have to make up your mind? Yes to one and let the other one ride. There's so many changes and tears you must hide. Did you ever have to finally decide?
President Trump got a victory of sorts from the Supreme Court this week. The justices said Trump's travel ban, directed at six majority Muslim nations, could go ahead with some conditions, overruling several state and federal courts that found the ban unconstitutional. But the court also said it would protect those coming to the U.S. to, say, visit a relative or accept a job. In agreeing to take up the case, the court said it would hear arguments when the new term starts in October. Robert Barnes covers the court for The Washington Post, and he's here to make sense of it all. Robert, thanks a lot for helping us out here.
Sure, my pleasure.
Hopefully you can explain this better than I just did. It's a temporary lifting of the lower court rulings that held up the travel ban in the first place. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. Remember that President Trump, almost immediately upon taking office, issued an executive order that sort of caused chaos at airports in this country and elsewhere because it went into effect immediately and it stranded people. And U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit put that on hold. The president said he was going to go to the Supreme Court, but he didn't. He waited a while, and he rewrote it and issued a second executive order. And then that was put on hold eventually by appeals courts on the East Coast and on the West Coast. And so that's what came to the Supreme Court. And the court basically did something that neither side had asked for. The challengers had said, leave these stays in place. The administration said no, lift them so that they could go into effect right away. And the court found a middle ground. As you said, it said that for travelers from those countries who have some sort of tie to the United States, either family members here or a job waiting, or, for instance, they were going to start at an American university, that those were people who should be able to get visas and enter the country. But it said that when we're talking about people who have no connection to the United States, that's when the president's power is at its peak, and that the courts don't need to interfere in that, at least right now. And so they said that those people would still have trouble getting into the U.S. And then they said the same thing, the same basic rules apply to refugees, because the executive order called for the refugee system to be shut down for 120 days.
So when Trump called it a clear victory for his argument, is he correct?
I'm not sure I would call it a clear victory. I think it was a compromise. But it was certainly, if it had gone the other way, it would have certainly been a clear defeat. And this was the first court, this was the first time the courts said, yes, at least part of this ban goes into effect. Remember that this ban is only supposed to be in effect while the administration decides whether the vetting procedures for all of these folks are stringent enough that the government can feel secure that they're not letting dangerous people into the country. So the Supreme Court also said to the administration, go ahead and start that vetting process and, you know, make it snappy.
Well, he originally asked for that 90-day ban. So is 90 days starting from yesterday, or how does this work?
You're asking a lot of hard questions, because that's not clear. You know, one of the things that the court's going to consider in the fall is whether this whole thing is moot, because it's already been a very long time. As I say, the first executive order was in January. The second one came out in March. And so the court said, you know, we're giving you plenty of time. You know, it's very possible that by the time the Supreme Court actually gets to the merits of this case in the fall, this will be moot. The administration will have had time to look at these procedures and either made this ban permanent or come up with a different ban or, you know, do something completely different. So there are a lot of unanswered questions about this that won't be settled for a while.
It just seemed odd to me to hear the court offer a decision on a subject before arguments were even made.
Well, remember, this was a stay. So this is what the lower courts had done, too. The lower courts hadn't really heard the merits of the case. They just said that it appeared that the administration had gone too far. One court said violated the Constitution. Another court said had exceeded the powers that the law gives the president. And so the court is often called upon to stay decisions of lower courts, and they do that before they hear the merits of the case.
I thought it was interesting, at least when I heard some of the, I guess it was at least one of the lower courts, they threw back some of Trump's words during the campaign about his ban on Muslims entering the U.S. Did the Supreme Court have anything to say on that?
No. The Supreme Court didn't get into that amount of detail. The court only dealt with this idea of can the ban go into effect right now or not. You know, one thing that was interesting about the court's opinion, I thought, is that what you were talking about with those lower court decisions, there was some really sort of charged rhetoric and writing in those opinions. This from the court was very low-key, very matter-of-fact, didn't get into the issue of whether the president's tweets or campaign statements could be used. That's all something that would come in the fall.
I know there were other decisions released by the court this week, but let me ask you, what's been your impression of the newest justice, Neil Gorsuch?
Well, I wrote about him. He is very assertive, very self-assured. He has really very quickly asserted himself on the court. He writes a lot and is not afraid to disagree with his colleagues. And, you know, on the last day, for instance, we found out because of different positions that he took that he was farther to the right than most of his colleagues on gun rights. He is skeptical of the reach of the Supreme Court's decision 2 years ago that granted constitutional right for same-sex marriage. On a host of issues, he has shown himself to be quite conservative.
One thing that many people were bracing for did not happen, and that's the retirement of Anthony Kennedy, who's considered the court's swing justice. Were you surprised that there was no announcement?
I wasn't surprised. You know, Kennedy himself hasn't talked about this. It's all been sort of speculation and a feeling by some of his former clerks that he is getting ready to retire. You know, I think there's no doubt that he's thinking about it. He turns 81 this summer. He's been on the court nearly 30 years. But the speculation sort of was built around the fact that he had been slow to hire some clerks for the coming term, although he's done that now, and that he had planned a big reunion of his clerks, a big black tie dinner at the Supreme Court that was planned, you know, basically for the last weekend before the court finished its work. And a number of people thought that maybe that was a bit of a valedictory.
But I guess, you know, whenever you see media reports like that, that it always leads to media frenzies. And I think there's no question that the retirement of a swing vote like Kennedy to be followed by a Trump pick that can't get filibustered, that would be a major event.
There would be nothing bigger about the Supreme Court than that, because he is the essential justice on the Supreme Court. You know, it is nearly impossible for either the four liberals on the court or the four more conservative members of the court to prevail on an issue unless Justice Kennedy is on their side. And so there are a whole host of issues that really depend on Tony Kennedy.
I was going to say, if he's gone, I think both the left and the right would say that the future of Roe could be in the balance, couldn't it?
That abortion rights is one, affirmative action is one. Justice Kennedy is the justice who's written every one of the court's major decisions on gay rights. He is sort of one of the essential votes on campaign finance. You know, liberals are begging him to stay right now, but they were also very upset because he's the one who wrote the opinion in Citizens United. So he really is the deciding vote on so many things at the Supreme Court.
And of course, the fact that he didn't announce it this week doesn't mean he couldn't announce his retirement next month or in the next several months, right? I mean,
that's right. I think, you know, the justices try not to do that kind of thing. They like, you know, especially a court that's just gone for 13 months with only 8 members. I think they wouldn't want to go through that again. And I don't know that he'd want to be a lame duck. But you're right that he could announce it at any time.
Robert Barnes covers the Supreme Court for The Washington Post. He's on Twitter at SCOTUS Reporter. Robert, thanks again for your insight.
Thank you.
If you leave me now, you'll take away the biggest part of me.
The court is going to take up another explosive issue in the fall, partisan redistricting. Gerrymandering, the term used to describe the actions of state legislatures to redraw congressional and local district lines to benefit their own party's interests, has been a political tool for as long as it's been politics and politicians. They do it, plain and simple, to protect their own political skins. The stories are endless and, depending on what side you're on, entertaining. The complaints these days are mostly about Republican overreach, but I remember many instances when Democrats had the power and they did everything they could to make life miserable for the GOP. Case in point, San Francisco Congressman Phil Burton redrawing California's districts in 1982 that ultimately gave the Democrats 6 additional seats in the Golden State alone. He had Republican incumbents running against each other, or he put them in impossible districts to win, or he eliminated their districts altogether. My contribution to modern art is how Burton put it. But as I said lately, especially since 2010, it's been the Republican state legislatures and governors who have been redrawing the maps, and in many cases, they have put Phil Burton to shame. And it has been brought to the attention of the Supreme Court, which will hear arguments about a Wisconsin redistricting case in the fall. Justin Levitt is a professor of constitutional law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles and served in the Obama Justice Department as a deputy assistant attorney general in the Civil Rights Division. He's an expert on the subject of redistricting and, in fact, writes the All About Redistricting website, which, as you might guess, is all about redistricting. Professor Levitt, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you very much, Ken. I appreciate you having me on.
We've had instances of partisan redistricting going back forever. Why is the court suddenly interested?
You're absolutely right that we've had instances forever, and you're absolutely right that they've been perpetrated by both Republicans and Democrats whenever the opportunity is allowed. I don't know that the court's suddenly interested. It's more like it's suddenly interested again. So this has been a thorny topic, and ever since the court dipped a toe into what it called the political thicket in the 1960s, wading directly into how district lines are drawn, it's tried to grapple and not completely succeeded in grappling with how to regulate or whether to regulate partisan gerrymandering.
Well, I mean, we do know that the court has been involved in gerrymandering when it involves racial discrimination. We saw that in North Carolina and I guess in Virginia as well. But in North Carolina, they ruled both the state legislative seats and congressional districts. They had to redraw them because of the fact that race was used in the drawing of lines. That's illegal, but there's never been a decision that said that partisan redistricting is unconstitutional.
That's right, or at least there's never been a decision finding a particular line drawing unconstitutional, not from the Supreme Court. The court has said, the last time it tackled the issue in 2004, the court said very clearly, nine justices said very clearly, that too much partisanship in the process is unconstitutional. The court really disagreed, though, on how much is too much and who should say how much is too much. And those two issues have been the stickiest issues ever since the court tried to take up the question in the first place. The case that's coming up to the court now, the thing that they'll confront in the fall and hopefully resolve one way or another in the spring, is the latest opportunity for the court to weigh in detail on how much might be too much, how you know how much is too much, and who should tell how much is too much.
Well, Republicans are arguing, I mean, their argument is basically that, yes, this system has been going on forever, but because they've been so good at it, now everybody's getting outraged. How do you react to that charge?
Yeah, I think you can trace the outrage to whoever's not in power at the moment. Ask Republicans in Maryland how they feel about it, and they're pretty ticked off at partisan gerrymandering. Ask Republicans in Illinois how they feel about it, and they're pretty ticked off at partisan gerrymandering. I think that much of the reaction now is coming from Democrats or Democratic supporters. That's true. But that is exactly, as you say, a product of who had more control over the process when the lines were drawn this past time. In prior decades, Democrats have had more control and Republicans were screaming bloody murder about them. And so I think you're right in the setup. The issue actually affects voters and politicians of both parties. And there's equal opportunity for offense and equal opportunity to want the court to put some bounds on the process.
Now, what the court is taking up this fall is not the congressional redistricting. But before we get to what the court is actually doing, remind us some of the more egregious cases of gerrymandering with congressional seats.
I think you're right that it changes over time. And you're pointing to the California gerrymander from the Burtons. And their era was certainly recognized as not just a contribution to modern art, but also an extremely effective act of political hardball. Texas was an extreme gerrymander protecting Democrats in the 90s and an extreme gerrymander protecting Republicans in the 2000s and this past year. In fact, Texas is a repeat offender on this and many other electoral fronts. Right now, I think some of the more extreme examples are, as you mentioned, North Carolina at the moment, Pennsylvania at the moment, perhaps Michigan on the Republican side. But here, too, where the Democrats have had control, they certainly did not often hesitate. And Maryland and Illinois are substantial Democratic-favoring gerrymanders this cycle. Where the next completely skewed maps will be depends in large part on control of the process in 2020 when the new census comes out and when the new maps are drawn in 2021. And without the court stepping in, I wouldn't expect it to be entirely predictable who's going to have more control, because a lot of that comes down to who wins state houses over the next 4 years.
In the old days when they used to redraw their lines, I mean, it was mostly a bunch of partisan Democrats or Republicans, whoever was in charge, would redraw the lines. But now they have these computer programs and these computer experts who sit down with the politicians and get these lines drawn. That's pretty remarkable.
The technology, I think, has made the process a little more accessible. But I don't know that it's added a tremendous amount to the politicians who really knew every nook and cranny of a state. Phil Burton would be hard-pressed to find somebody who knew every street in California better than Phil Burton. And so what really the technology has done is it allows people without the incumbent politicians' particular expertise in their districts. And there is nobody who knows a district better than the person who represents it, knows where their voters are and knows where their voters aren't. The technology has allowed others to come in and put a more national gloss on redistricting plans and has opened the process up so that you don't have to have quite that level of innate expertise or familiarity with the various communities around, that you can come and apply data from the outside. That's also, by the way, helped groups outside of the process engage with the process.
The case that the court is going to be looking at in the fall, which is in Wisconsin, is more about state legislative districts. Tell me what's happening there.
Well, it comes out of state legislative districts. That's absolutely right. But it really applies to the rules across the country. What the court finds here, if the court decides that it can figure out how much is too much, will apply specifically to Wisconsin state legislative districts. But really, it'll be setting rules for the country as a whole. And that's not just Wisconsin state legislature. It's congressional districts and state legislative districts and even local districts all around the country. The reason that Wisconsin state legislative districts are sort of front and center right now is that a case was brought for the very first time. They convinced a lower court, a trial court, to strike down the way particular districts are drawn based on partisanship. And that's in part based on a measure concocted by two political scientists, one in California, one in Chicago, that shows that Wisconsin state legislative districts are really a strong outlier, that if you set about breaking up an opposing party's strength by either breaking them into multiple small districts or combining them all in one district so that there were few supporters outside of that district, you could actually measure that. And if you measured all the state legislative plans in the country, Wisconsin's really on a pretty far extreme in terms of breaking up Democratic votes there or combining Democratic votes into super PAC'd districts. And that's part of why the litigation has proceeded through Wisconsin.
Well, I think the argument, the Democratic argument, was that the Republicans won 60 of the 99 seats, but the Democratic candidates got the most votes.
Yeah, and you see that in a number of states where there were more votes either in individual congressional races or statewide for one party, and another party retains legislative control. Now, there are multiple factors behind all of that. Individual turnout in individual races matters. Individual candidates matter. The geographic distribution of people who prefer a particular party matter. Other factors matter. All of that was thrown into the mix, and really what the political scientists discovered in Wisconsin is that even given all of that, the resulting benefit to the Republican Party was so extreme. And the other procedural elements of how the maps were developed in Wisconsin were so extreme that it could be the basis for helping the court find its way to a standard for evaluating partisan gerrymanders more generally.
So are you saying that if the court rules against the Republicans, or at least the plan in Wisconsin, does that mean that the Republican redistricting in Pennsylvania or the Democratic redistricting in Maryland gets thrown out, or does each state take its own case to the court? Well, what happens?
So first of all, I don't know that it'd be the court ruling against the Republicans so much as the court ruling for the voters. I mean, it's important for all of us to remember that whenever a particular members of a political party's incumbents get to draw their own lines and do so by intentionally punishing the other party, that makes it harder for all of us to keep them in line and keep them in check. And so when it's the politicians choosing their voters rather than the other way around, that means the system's really gone awry.
Point taken. Good.
Now, that said, what the court decides in Wisconsin is not automatically going to throw out any other lines. It will decide on a standard and either throw out Wisconsin's state legislative lines or not. But whatever the court decides is going to have a big impact on litigation going forward. We're getting to be late in the cycle. And so I know that in this era of news, the next couple hours are all anybody can be bothered to think about, because there's more than enough news to fill up that time. But in terms of the political cycle, in terms of the electoral cycle, we are very, very, very close to the next census. And we're very, very close to, as a result, districts all over the country, local, state, federal, getting redrawn. And so it's not clear, whatever the court decides, whether it will have an impact immediately on the districts that currently exist. That depends in large part on what they decide and how they decide and the scope of litigation that's already in place. But what we do know is whatever the court decides is going to have a huge impact on how the lines are drawn when they're next redrawn. And that's coming up really soon.
Because the folks who will be redrawing the lines in 2020 are the folks who are going to be being elected in 2018. So, as you say, this election is right around the corner.
That's right. And it's also the folks who are going to be redrawing the lines in 2020 will have to consider, if the Supreme Court sets or clarifies new rules, they'll have to consider those new rules. So, yeah, the elections in 2018 are going to matter a lot. The elections in 2020 are going to matter a lot. And all of that is going to take place on a field, on a landscape, that the Supreme Court's going to be shaping when it decides this case over the course of the next year.
There are several states, like California and Arizona and Iowa, I think there are maybe a few others, that don't allow partisan redistricting. Explain, if you can, what's happening in those states.
So there are some states, very few, that have tried to put in a rule that says no matter who's drawing the lines, you can't redistrict for partisan gain or for partisan disfavor. You can't reward or punish based on party when you draw the lines. It's a state like Florida actually did that in 2010. More other states, and California and Arizona, like you suggested, are among them, have tried to tamp down excessive partisanship in the process by giving the pen over to some other body. In most states across the country, it's the legislature that's drawing the lines, and that leads to a pretty obvious conflict of interest. If I had control over my job next year, I'd do what I could to keep it. And the legislatures pretty naturally do the same. In states like California and Arizona, and by the way, Idaho and Washington, it's not necessarily one political perspective that's prompted this, because the conflict exists no matter what. States have turned to more independent redistricting bodies, trusting a commission of individuals who are not themselves politicians and who don't have the same natural conflict of interest to draw the lines for state legislature and sometimes for Congress. And where that has been in place, it's actually worked fairly well. Each state has a different model of commission, and the right model for California is not necessarily the right model for Idaho or vice versa. But the states that have found their way to a more independent process have taken some of the gas out of the incentive to redraw the lines purely for partisan benefit, not for public benefit.
Do we think that maybe, you know, the California, the Iowas, the Arizonas, do we think those states, those systems may be the wave of the future regarding redistricting?
They're certainly picking up steam. They're picking up steam a lot faster in states that allow citizens to vote on changing the laws of the state directly, ballot initiatives and the like. It's harder to get a structure like that through when the legislature controls the keys to the door. But I would say popular taste for these sorts of structures and their nitty-gritty, wonky issues, but people understand they make a huge impact on a lot of other political issues down the line. Popular taste for it has shown that it's something that when citizens are presented with the opportunity, they usually take.
Justin Levitt is a professor of constitutional law at Loyola Law School and writes the All About Redistricting website, which can be found at redistricting.lls.edu. Justin, it was great having you on the program.
Thanks very much.
I'm a political man, and I practice what I preach.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our most recent trivia question, which was, who was the last female lieutenant governor who went on to be elected governor of her state? The answer, Mary Fallon of Oklahoma. While the route wasn't direct, she served two terms in Congress in between. She was first elected lieutenant governor in 1994, was re-elected twice more, and then, after her congressional service, was elected governor of Oklahoma in 2010. A Republican, Fallon still serves in her second term. And the randomly selected winner is Joe Easton of Rochester, New York. Joe wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttlebutt winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or a concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. It's been a while since the last puzzle. That's what back surgery does to you. But anyway, that last contest led off with a button that just had the letter A on it. That was followed by a Richard Nixon button and an Edward Kennedy button. After that, a button that read, Nixon's the one, Agnew's the two. And finally, an I Love McGov button for George McGovern. So when you combine A with Dick, with Ted, with two, with love, you kind of get a Dick Ted to love. And you might as well face it. The winner is Nomi Levine of Berkeley, California. We'll have a new scuttlebutt puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. The polls tell us that Donald Trump may be having serious problems with the American public. His job approval numbers are hovering just under 40%. His policies at home, his adventures overseas, questions about Russia and collusion and all that stuff, that all hangs over him. That was all supposed to be good news for the Democrats, who are still talking about winning the 24 House seats to put them back in the majority in 2018 and make Nancy Pelosi Speaker once again. But in the four special congressional elections called because the Republican incumbents left to join the Trump administration, all four stayed with the GOP. Most disheartening for the Democrats, the special election last week in Georgia, where their candidate had spent $23 million and where some polls had him winning. John Ossoff had received 48% of the vote in the all-candidate primary back in April, just short of an outright victory, and he finished last week with 48% of the vote. He failed to pick up new voters. Was it a referendum on Trump? Hardly. Maybe one on Nancy Pelosi.
Nancy Pelosi's friends are bankrolling Ossoff's campaign because Ossoff will rubber stamp her liberal agenda. Higher taxes on the middle class, job-destroying regulations, billions in new spending. Don't be fooled. Liberal John Ossoff is a rubber stamp for Pelosi's agenda. John Ossoff is one of them. Ossoff will vote with Nancy Pelosi for more spending, bigger government, and a weaker military. Don't let them hijack our congressional seat. Stop Ossoff now.
This led to some longtime Pelosi critics in the Democratic Party, such as Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan, to once again air his complaints with his party's strategy and its leadership. Here he is on CNN with anchor Don Lemon.
We all have a lot of anger towards what Donald Trump is doing, but we've had four special elections and Donald Trump 4, Democrats 0.
So then they went after Nancy Pelosi. Is Nancy Pelosi, does she sum up the Democratic brand?
Well, I think in some sense, yeah. I mean, she does. Clearly, we're coming off an election and she's been getting pounded now for 10 years with negative ads from the Republicans. I don't think it's fair. But clearly these ads using her, linking her to our candidates, is still working.
Nancy Pelosi is more toxic than Donald Trump?
You know what? The honest answer is, in some areas of the country, yes, she is.
Kathleen Rice, a Democratic member of Congress from New York, added this on MSNBC's Morning Joe.
I've been very clear that we need leadership change. There's no question about it. You know, I sat in a meeting the other day and I listened to a rationale as to how we should be happy as a caucus because we didn't lose as badly this past 2 days ago as we did a year ago. But we're still losing. And that's my concern. We need to find a different path. We need to have a vision. Where do we want to go? And we need to have a message, which is how are we going to get there? Nancy Pelosi was a great speaker. She is a great leader, but her time has come and gone. Yes, she's a great fundraiser, but if the money that we are raising with her through her leadership is not helping us win elections, then we have to have this difficult conversation now.
And that's not all. On the same day John Ossoff and his $23 million were losing 52-48 in Georgia, an underfunded, unknown Democrat with no national attention or national support was defeated in a South Carolina special election by an even closer margin, 51-48. It was for the seat given up by now Budget Director Mick Mulvaney, a seat Mulvaney won by 20 points last year. But no national Democratic groups came in, there was no serious effort to turn out black voters, and a potential opportunity was snuffed out. Is the answer new tactics, new leadership, both? Kathleen Decker has been wrestling with these questions as well. She's a political columnist for the Los Angeles Times and a frequent visitor to the Political Junkie. Kathleen, it's great having you back on the program.
Good to be back.
Well, I've been hearing from some Democrats in the past few days that they knew they never were going to win in Georgia or South Carolina or Montana, where the special elections were. But during the campaigns, and especially in Georgia, there was a lot of talk about Democratic momentum and party enthusiasm and this disdain for Donald Trump, and it didn't happen.
Well, it did happen to a lesser degree. They did narrow the margin in all of those areas. And I think, to be honest, although they said different things, Democrats really didn't expect to pick up most of those seats or all of those seats. But they did have high hopes for Georgia, given the money that was raised and given the action that Hillary Clinton was able to pull off there last November. That gave them more hope than in the prior three districts.
You're saying that Hillary Clinton lost that district by only a point and a half to Trump.
Right, exactly. Whereas Trump had won the other districts much more handily. But it did, I think, the totality of the special elections this year did say to Democrats that it's not necessarily going to be a referendum on Donald Trump when you go into these races, that voters in some ways look at Trump and Republicans as separate entities. And in some ways, Republicans have been able to triangulate against the president and the Democratic candidate in these races. They come off looking more reasonable sometimes than a president who is venting constantly on Twitter and taking positions that are anathema to even Republicans. And so there's been some benefit. And these are Republican districts. And that is the other problem that Democrats face next year. They will be running largely to recapture a majority. They would be running in districts that have voted Republican recently. And so there's going to have to be a really acute effort to try to pull off the number of victories that they will need to get the majority.
And they're going to be running against incumbents, as we saw in the special elections. It's always tougher to run against an incumbent than it is to run in an open district.
Yes and no, I would say, for argument's sake. Absolutely tougher to run against an incumbent because of the money, the name identification, and all the sort of institutional surroundings that an incumbent has. And Democrats did have the advantage this time in running against people who were lesser known than an incumbent would have been. But I do think that the incumbents are going to have to be taking votes that are tough. You look at the healthcare vote, and granted, you know, the healthcare plans are popular and unpopular to different degrees in different districts, but even Republicans have not embraced the Senate healthcare plan. And so you will have incumbents who will have to have cast votes on that plan and on the other things that are coming up down the road. The one advantage that the newcomers, the Republican newcomers, had in the special elections is that they could create some distance, that they hadn't had to be on the line and voting for a plan that nationally 17% of Americans support and really not you know, not a majority in a lot of cases of Republicans even support.
You know, I know historical comparisons are often wrong, and so here's my opportunity to be wrong. But I often think back to 1974 and how unpopular President Nixon was, and how Democrats ran not against their Republican opponents, but Nixon himself. As you pointed out, the efforts to run against Trump is not working, is not apparently these special elections, although there's only been four so far, but these have not been referenda against Trump. But clearly it seems like Democrats are mistaken if they think that by running against Trump is going to propel them to victory.
I think that there's a case that they need to make affirmatively for themselves. And that's a bit of a muddle right now because the Democratic Party itself has schisms, just as the Republican Party does. But I do think that you know, an issue-based campaign that talks about the various things that the administration is doing policy-wise perhaps has more chance of success than an one-off against Trump. The president inspires a lot of animosity among Democrats and increasingly among independents, but he has a very loyal following to this point among Republicans. And so you saw in the Georgia race, particularly, and in the more high profile these races are, the more there tends to be a sort of splashback effect, and increased Democratic interest in the race propels increased Republican interest in the race. And we saw that in Georgia, that there was a big turnout from people who were, in effect, saying, you know, I'm going to stand up for my party here. I'm not going to let them roll over us. And so I think that there's a balance that needs to be struck between reminding people of the unpopular things the president has done, but not in a way that suggests that every Republican candidate is identical to Donald Trump, because they just don't come across that way.
And let me get back to Nancy Pelosi. I mean, I remember the Republicans trying to run a national campaign against Speaker Tip O'Neill. The Democrats were running national campaigns against Newt Gingrich. But I'm just wondering, I was thinking back to that CNN interview I just played a few minutes ago. Is it possible that, certainly in some districts, but is it possible that in some ways she's become more toxic than Donald Trump?
Well, I think that among some groups she certainly is. But then again, among some groups, Trump is more toxic. I mean, the goal of those advertisements run in the Georgia race was to boost Republican turnout. And there's no better way to boost Republican turnout than by reminding them that they hate Nancy Pelosi. Until now, they hated Barack Obama or they hated Hillary Clinton. And Pelosi has been a kind of a greatest hits on the attack wheel of Republicans. And that plays on a whole lot of cultural things. It plays on the notion of, you know, California being sort of the big Megilla coming in to control your lives. And people in Georgia and a lot of other states don't like that. And so it had some sort of cultural resonance as well as political resonance. But it's certainly, as you indicated, it's not uncommon. It's typically what happens. It has a little bit of a added dazzle, I think, because it's a California political figure and a woman.
Well, Pelosi herself said there was nothing to be ashamed of by the defeat in Georgia.
The fact is, we're very proud of the race that was run there. The candidate who carried the banner, John Ossoff, had a great campaign. I was interested in some of the statements of the people from Georgia saying, hey, we reduced by 20 points what the advantage had been in that district for the Republicans. This is good news for us, for our legislative races, and the fact is we're very proud.
Basically, that is exactly what you would expect the Democratic leader to say. They're not going to say after the fact, boy, we really blew it and we should have done X, Y, or Z different. I mean, the game right now is keeping enthusiasm alive to try to pull in a very prominent class of potential challengers next time out and to continue the money flow the way it has been lately. But I do think that there is a tension here. Any leader of any party wants to pull in the maximum number of members of their party to success in order to win the majority. We saw that 10 years ago when Democrats took back the House and they had a huge number of Blue Dog Democrats who didn't agree with the party on a lot of cultural issues but were Democrats, and that allowed them to achieve the majority. This time out, you have the need to do that sort of thing because those are the kinds of Democrats who are going to have a better shot in some of these Republican-held districts. but you have the ground energy of the party and the money donations and all, and the troops, you know, protesting everywhere, come from the liberal left of the party, and they are interested in defining the party in their way. So there's going to be some tension back and forth, it seems to me, between the sort of joint desire to claim a majority and the question of what road you take to get there.
Remembering, I was just thinking as you were saying that, remember in the beginning, in the, I guess it was the initial Georgia primary, where Bernie Sanders wouldn't even endorse John Ossoff. I think he had to be pushed into it because he didn't feel he was progressive enough.
Exactly. Yeah, because he was, Ossoff was running a very centrist economic message that was basically jobs, jobs, jobs in Georgia, and not playing ball with the Bernie crowd. You similarly had in the mayoral race in Nebraska, I think it was.
Omaha, right.
You had Bernie endorsing a candidate, and you had a lot of women's groups coming up and saying, wait a minute, he's not completely on our side in terms of abortion rights. So there have been burps along the way that demonstrate that different aspects of the party want different things.
It just hits me as strange, you know, looking at Trump's numbers, the public's view of the health care bill, the concern about Russia and collusion, and yet somehow it's the Democrats who seem to be on the defensive after having lost four in a row.
Well, I think part of what we don't know yet is how this is going to play out next year. I mean, if there's one thing we all should have learned last year, it's not to predict anything that's going to happen in the next 5 minutes, much less a year down the road. So, you know, there is a tradition of parties losing in special elections the year before midterms and then coming back and winning significantly in the midterms. And we don't fully know the issue set that will be important in 2018, but it's hard to argue that healthcare won't be a big component of it, and Democrats do have an edge on that. So I think that a lot of what Trump has done, it seems to me, and I wrote a piece on this a couple weeks ago, is he has essentially blown apart the rationale for both parties. Democrats are split over what they believe and how far they want to go on issues like healthcare and pay and equity and things like that and school financing, just as they were in the 2016 race. Republicans, you know, what do Republicans stand for? You can't tell looking at the health care bill or looking at what's going on in Congress. It's everybody is sort of mushed around right now, and Trump is the large figure at the center of all this. And I think what we have now is we have sort of political parties, both of them, the major ones, confronting the fact that younger voters particularly don't like to belong to them. They don't want to be, you know, part of a party. They like to think of themselves as independent, and older voters are essentially sick of both parties because they feel like neither one is delivered. And so you have a sort of existential crisis going on, it seems to me, in both parties. And right now the Democrats, having lost four races, I will point out that they did win a congressional seat in California, which was a Democrat versus Democrat race. But having lost four of five, Democrats are in the hot seat now. I suspect in a year from now, we may see a different thing.
Well, one thing I can't predict is that Kathleen Decker is a political columnist for the Los Angeles Times. How's that? That's pretty good, right?
That's good.
Kathleen, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Don't worry, baby, you've forgotten.